From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler.
Singer-songwriter Rebecca Frazier will perform in Columbus on Friday, January 16th with six-string concerts, along with Iris Dement, at the Columbus Performing Arts Center's Shed Theater. More information is available at www.craftthetheshow.com. Welcome to Craft, Rebecca Frazier.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me, Doug.
Well, your most recent album, 2013's When We Fall, showcased your writing prowess. Tell me about this album and the writing of it.
Well, this was definitely a new experience for me. I had been working for years and years with Hit and Run out in Colorado, and then took a break to have children. And going back into music, I was inspired to write most of my next project. And as a lot of people know, you know, getting married and having children, it helps to mature you, I think, in a way that kind of helps you be inspired to write more mature songs. And it was a long process, maybe about 5 years worth of writing, boiled down into what I thought were the best 10 songs I could offer. And some of them were co-written with my husband. We would make writing appointments, and I would bring songs down that I'd written, and he would help to edit them and make them better. And then some of them were songs or instrumentals that I'd just written on my own.
Well, let's talk about one in specific, one in particular, When We Fall. How did that one arise? Was that something that you worked on with your husband? Is that a solo on the writing of the lyrics and the music? How did that go?
The actual song, When We Fall, it's the title track of the album, and it's actually probably my favorite song on the album because it was really just a gift from a dream.
A lot of people, a lot of love, we still
I heard the melody in a dream, and I heard a voice singing words in that kind of weird dreamlike way we often have. And I woke up and sang most of what I could remember into my iPhone immediately before I could forget it. And later on that day, while I was still inspired by that occurrence, I went up to my attic and was just thinking about a lot of the, you know, biblical imagery that I associated with some of the words that had come from the dream, and just finished the song in that sitting. Actually, I didn't exactly finish it, because later on, when I sang it for friends, a couple of people I know mentioned that they didn't really understand what the song was about. And that often happens with songwriters. Know exactly what a song's about, mm-hmm. but the listener can't put two and two together. And that's when I added that bridge in, which I think helped the song a lot. I hadn't necessarily agreed until I added it, and it just became a song that was about, you know, it had different meanings, about falling down and getting back up, mm-hmm. and about self-reflection, and about the biblical fall and kind of metaphors having to do with that.
Okay. So did you get the opportunity to go back to the person who didn't get it the first time and say, now there, do you get it now?
No. Yes. Yes. And actually, that's the best thing you can do, is just play a song for fresh ears. And if they're staring up with a smile and wow, or if they're like, huh? But yes, without explaining anything, just came back to that person and played the song with the edits, and she was like, yes, that totally makes sense now.
Okay, good. How often do you get those kind of reactions that change songs for you? Is that something that you really look for input from other people, or is this a one-shot deal that, you know, they didn't seem to get it and you decided to change it?
Well, that's a good question. I'm a firm believer that songwriting is a craft. And I think just like writing fiction or writing anything else, we need objective opinions, and we need feedback. It's not this mystical art form, you know. I mean, it is that too, and there are important moments of inspiration, but you can't really be struck by lightning if you're not working at it constantly. Mm-hmm. And as, I'm guilty of not working at it constantly because of the touring I do to support the albums. And I think, like a lot of writers, I get into a writing mode to get ready for the next album. But I think feedback is really important.
Okay.
But only if you trust the listener not to ruin your confidence.
Okay. Now, you said that you get into a writing mode. What characterizes that writing mode? How do you know that it's, I mean, instead of just saying, okay, now I'm in my writing mode, what is the way that you get into that is for writing?
Well, actually, one of the ways for me is saying, okay, now I'm in writing mode.
Mm-hmm.
I have to actually sometimes, you know, tell myself, I'm supposed to be writing now. Because I love to flat pick my guitar, and you know, I love to fool around on the piano and the mandolin and other instruments too. And since I have two really small kids, my music time is just like everybody. My time for dedicated to music is not, you know, 12 hours a day.
Right.
But sometimes I need just to say, my music time today needs to be devoted to writing.
Mm-hmm.
And get into that mindset. And that means, first of all, reviewing a lot of the ideas I've collected. In the old days, it would be in a notepad, and now it's on a notepad in my iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And just like most songwriters, I have, every time an idea comes to me out of the blue, I either record it on a voice memo or write down the idea on my notebook on my iPhone. And when I'm in my writing mode, I can sort through all those names and try to make some sense of them and see if there's anything there. And sometimes there'll be a great melody that I had come up with while I was driving one day, and that melody really works with that, you know, the lyrical idea I had on another day. You know, sometimes I'm lucky that way. And I know everybody goes about it differently, but for me, if I'm in the mode, the self-proclaimed writing mode,
mm-hmm.
I tend to have a better awareness and I'm open to ideas. So suddenly everything seems like a song. Every time someone says something funny or smart or sad, I'm like, oh, that's a great song. So once I'm in the mode, I'm more receptive to the ideas that are out there in the world.
You have a track on that same album, 2013's When We Fall, called Ain't Gonna Work Tomorrow, which suggests that that arose at the end of your being in the writer's mode, that you're discussing, you know, that's it, I'm done, I've done writing enough. Is that how that occurred? When did that one arise for you, the Ain't Gonna Work Tomorrow song?
Well, actually, that is a traditional lyric.
Oh, is it?
And okay. Yes. And that's the only traditional bluegrass song that made it. But my husband and I, we kind of rearranged that one, and I wrote some of the words to be from a female perspective. And that was back in 06 when we arranged that for Hit and Run. And Hit and Run had been performing it for years, and I just thought it was so much fun to perform, but I wanted to sing it from a woman's point of view.
I ain't gonna work tomorrow.
You can see that I'm not as familiar with bluegrass as I should be when I'm not recognizing the traditional tunes. So, you know, good job, Doug.
No, really, no judgment here. If I did an interview about any other form of music, I would be the same way.
Okay. Now, you mentioned Hit and Run Bluegrass, and that's a group that you formed while you were living in Colorado, and it was one of the first bands to win competitions at Rocky Grass and the Telluride Bluegrass Festival. So tell me about your work with the Hit and Run Bluegrass group. How does that differ, say, from your solo work?
Well, Well, the hit and run, we all met each other in our early 20s. One person was 19 and the age ranged up to probably about 26. And the goal was we were looking for a group of five hardworking, really dedicated people who wanted to focus on playing in a really tight bluegrass group. And we really wanted to tour around bluegrass festivals. We just thought that sounded like the best possible thing we could do. And it was a lot of fun because we lucked out and were able to gather this group of five like-minded people and all wonderful musicians and great people. And we were out west, which meant that a lot of our touring, after we won those two contests, the Rocky Grass and Telluride, we were getting invited out to festivals all over, you know, New Mexico and California and Nevada and Utah. And we played pretty much every western state. So you can imagine how, you know, passing by the Hoover Dam and Grand Canyon and had a great time. We made it out to the east on quite a few tours also. And our records were always produced and recorded back east, either in Virginia or North Carolina, and we were really looking to be what we felt like was a traditional / contemporary bluegrass band, and we were really concerned with finding material that we thought was, you know, original and would say something to listeners who weren't necessarily drawn to only bluegrass.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we'd find, you know, lyrical content that wasn't necessarily about my grandpappy on the cabin and a lot of this, you know, stereotypical bluegrass lyrics. It's not that we didn't like those lyrics, but we wanted kind of more of a modern connection, I guess.
Have you found that modern connection through Hit and Run, working with them? You've put out a couple of albums, right?
Yeah, we put out a couple albums, and a lot of people have heard of us through Sirius and touring, and it was very self-run. We didn't hire a publicist or anything. We didn't have a record label. My solo experience has been quite a bit different because I live in Nashville now, and I've made a lot of, you know, connections with publicists, and of course, this one I put out on Compass Records, which is an independent bluegrass and world music label in Nashville. And the experience has been really, really great for me to see how this network of professionals can help to bring the music to a broader audience. And it's still, you know, obviously a niche record because it's predominantly a bluegrass record. But it's had a lot of great airplay on Sirius, and it's been an entirely different experience doing it on my own instead of with a team, you know,
right,
a group of five people. But part of it had to do with my new phase in life as a wife and a mother instead of, as, you know, 25-year-old. It's just worked better for me to do it this way.
Right.
And also, to be honest, I didn't have as much to say back then. I could say that really honestly. Like, what did a 25-year-old have to say? I mean, they have a lot to say, but I felt like I was just kind of bursting at the seams with more artistic ideas. And part of it was being cooped up in pregnancies. And, you know, my husband was out touring for a lot of years with John Cowan after we moved to Nashville. And I just had much more time for self-reflection than I did when we were sitting in a van together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're up, say, you know, I've got two kids, if you're up feeding at night or something like that, it does give you those moments of, you know, you're sort of sitting there waiting for somebody to fall asleep and a lot of time to think.
Yeah.
What is the name, Hit and Run Bluegrass? How did that come about? Because it has, I assume, a couple different connotations besides the, I mean, there's the hit, right? You want to have a hit. But there's also sort of the accident portion of it. So how does that name work for you?
Well, that's funny. It's not as interesting as that, actually. The name came, we wanted something that sounded bluegrassy. And people, right, a lot of times, if they think a bluegrass band is good, they'll say, wow, that's a really hard driving, you know, good driving bluegrass, hard driving. And we were trying to think of something having to do with that. And somebody said, somebody saw a sign on the road, Hidden Drive.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, that'd be cool, but that makes it sound like we're not driving. And then somebody said, that sounds like Hit and Run. And we're like, that is it. It just sounded right. Okay. It was the way we wanted the band to sound.
It makes it sound like you have the most dangerous band bus in bluegrass.
Yeah. We did have some things in the van. Not all from us, but quite a few from...
from pedestrians. Rebecca Fraser, I want to thank you very much for talking to me today, and we're looking forward to your Friday, January 16th concert with Six String Concerts, along with Iris DePent. So I look very much forward to seeing you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a thrill, and we're excited to come.
For more information from my guests, visit www.craftheshow.com. This is Doug Dangler. Until next time, be creative.